Our next case this morning is number 07-2206, Sean Gaylor against Astru. Ms. Goldblum.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Marcy Goldblum on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Sean Gaylor. Your Honors, in this case, which is one of the cases for Social Security disability, Mr. Gaylor has a long history of both back problems and depression. There's a few things I'd like to focus on this morning. Number one is that Judge Velasquez credited a finding reported by treating physicians that this gentleman couldn't relieve his pain by just changing positions once every 2 hours, which indicates that he wouldn't be able to fit his change of position and posture within the general 15-minute break for lunch, half hour and 15 in the afternoon. But what the judge did in order to accommodate that is he says, well, I'm going to credit that, and in order to accommodate it, I'm going to say that this gentleman is able to stand up, or if he'd been sitting down, or sit down if he's been standing, for up to 2 minutes every hour. So, in other words, he can stand up for up to 120 seconds every hour, and that's going to accommodate this need. Now, the problem with that is he doesn't explain at all how he comes to that finding. This court has said over and over again that the administrative law judge has to provide a reasonable nexus between the evidence and his conclusion. And particularly with regard to that specific finding, there is no bridge. There's no nexus. He devised it, thought he was being accommodating, but it doesn't relate to anything. And that's extremely problematic. The next thing that's erroneous in this case is that when Judge Velasquez issued his first decision in this case, the appeals counsel then remanded it and told the judge that he had to consider this gentleman's mental impairment. So then he held the second hearing and issued a second decision. And in that second decision, he does, in fact, talk about the mental impairments, but he never issues a credibility finding that takes into consideration all of the mental impairments. The judge credits Mr. Gaylor with having severe depression, but he never incorporates that severe depression in terms of looking at how it impacts depression, how it impacts his physical findings. In his decision, the judge says, it's evident that the claimant's depressed mood and anxiety are exacerbated by his preoccupation with his somatic problems and his daily stressors. But what he never looks at is how does that somatic preoccupation, how does that depression impact the physical in terms of his ability to sit, stand, etc. And that's incredibly significant in this case because Drs. Kashia, Micklemore, Trammell, all suggested that there was a psychological component going on here. This was a gentleman who, keep in mind, he had a lot of back problems, underwent surgery, went back to work in 2000 after the first surgery, and then January 4th, 2001, he stops working, alleges disability as of January 5th, 2001. At that time, Dr. Whitfield reports that there's definitely L5 radiculopathy, that there appears to be a herniated disc with compression of the nerves, positive straight leg signs. On January 11th, 2001, there's an EMG finding that shows that there's irritation of the L4-5 nerve roots. He goes through epidurals. He goes through all kinds of conservative treatment and ends up on October 15th, 2002, having a combined anterior posterior spinal fusion that has to be done in two different procedures. They go in through both the abdomen and the back to do both of those procedures. And then, unfortunately, after the fusion, rather than getting better, he continues to complain that he's having horrible pain and pain going down his legs. And he's taking a lot of pain medication. They're trying to wean him off of the narcotics, and he can't really do it. Doctors McLemore, Trammell, Kashia, they say, you know, we can't really do anything more for you. And they say, you know, you're going to need to go to pain management. And he goes to pain management, and he's also being treated by a psychiatrist. And when you look at the psychiatrist's notes, and the judge does in his second decision, and it week after week after week, he's focused on the somatic problems. He's having problems sleeping. He keeps thinking about his back. And what this judge fails to do, though, is he never, and particularly in the second decision, which is why we're here today, he never revisits the credibility finding, and he had to. Under Social Security ruling 96-7P, it specifically says when you're looking at pain, when you're looking at someone's reaction to pain and their presentation of it, you have to look at psychological aspects. Well, when this judge entered his credibility finding regarding the physical findings, he found that there was no severe mental impairment. So then when he issues the second decision and fails to revisit the credibility as it impacts on the physical impairments, then we don't have a full and fair decision. That's legal error that requires remand in this case. And finally, in terms of the psychological aspects itself, the administrative law judge says that he's going to credit Dr. Martin's report. Dr. Martin was the psychologist who examined this gentleman at the behest of the Social Security Administration. And his report includes a lot of findings that he's got a depressed outlook, that he has to, and interestingly, he has to get up and pace and walk around a little bit, which is very consistent with his having to get up more than 120 seconds every hour. But he then, his final report to Social Security is that this gentleman, although he needs to have some limitations, particularly in social settings, can basically handle a work setting. Well, then the attorney at the time, or the non-attorney representative at the time, submitted a report from the treating psychiatrist that said, you know, I disagree with that. I don't think my client, my patient can work. And furthermore, had the report from Dr. Martin reviewed by an expert forensic psychologist, and that's Dr. Czarnecki. Dr. Czarnecki submitted a report to Social Security that said, this report is flawed. The NMPI criteria that Dr. Martin cited to is wrong. Now, it's not our position that the ALJ had to accept one or the other, but if, as he did, was going to accept Dr. Martin's report over everything else, it was incumbent of him to at least explain what he was making of the fact that an expert psychologist pointed out a significant flaw in that report. So if he was going to accept that report despite all those flaws, at the very least he needed to explain the weight that he was giving to the fact that another psychologist had pointed out a very significant flaw in the reporting of the MMPI and the ultimate findings. He didn't do that. Instead, the ALJ went through the various psychological reports and said, you know, it seems to me that his daily activities and what was going on in terms of the reports from the treating psychiatrist just seem more consistent with Dr. Martin's report. Now, I disagree with that as well, but again, there was a lack of an explanation from the administrative law judge, and that's what this court has always held, that the administrative law judge needs to explain himself. There needs to be a reasonable explanation between the evidence and the final conclusion, and I submit that that's really what's missing in this case. Another thing is, I think when you look at the chronology from when this gentleman left work January 5th, 2001, through the time he has this complicated combined anterior-posterior fusion in October of 2002, it seems pretty clear that during that entire time, he wouldn't have been able to work at all, and yet the administrative law judge that doesn't seem to appreciate the fact that there may be discrete periods of time or that he could have awarded a closed period of benefits. Your Honors, if there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Goldblum. We'll hear now from Mr. Studinski.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Ed Studinski. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this matter. Plaintiff appellant, Mr. Gaylor, was 35 years old at the time of the administrative law judge's decision. He graduated from high school, completed some college. This case concerns his fourth application for disability insurance benefits. Mr. Gaylor has been trying to obtain disability benefits since he was 27 years old. Prior to this application, his most recent application followed a January 2000 back surgery. That application was denied in September 2000, and plaintiff sought no further review. While that application was being decided, Mr. Gaylor was working. Mr. Gaylor was working in a factory job while his application was pending, and he earned more than $22,000 during 2000. This is an individual who has a track record of applying for benefits despite his demonstrated capacity for work. He now alleges that he was disabled as of January 2001. Now, as a result of plaintiff's dogged pursuit of benefits over the years, this case does involve a lengthy administrative transcript with hundreds of pages of medical evidence in the form of treatment records, consultative examinations, test results. Some of this evidence, including opinions from treating and examining medical professionals, is consistent with Mr. Gaylor's claim that he is disabled. I don't dispute that. However, this record also contains evidence, including the opinions of treating and examining medical professionals, that plaintiff is not as impaired as he claims, and that he is, in fact, capable of performing substantial gainful activity. The administrative law judge, the assigned fact finder in this case, reasonably weighed all of this evidence of record, considering both the evidence that supported Mr. Gaylor's claim as well as evidence that was inconsistent with that claim. Ms. Goldblum has not identified any evidence of record that the ALJ failed to acknowledge. And in fact, we have two lengthy administrative law judge decisions containing detailed. Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like your view on how the ALJ treated the psychiatric evidence in light of the physical evidence. It seems to me he has to look at this man as a whole and decide whether, given the physical situation and the psychiatric situation, he's disabled. And I'm having trouble seeing how the ALJ satisfactorily did that.
Well, Your Honor, all of the psychiatric evidence, the mental evidence, was before him at the time of his first application, except for the plaintiff's representative sent the record out to this Dr. Czarnecki in order to specifically refute what was in the record, what the ALJ relied on. So we cannot suggest that the ALJ's first decision with the lengthy, detailed credibility assessment paid no attention and no heed to this individual's demonstrated mental treatment. Secondly, the second decision by the ALJ does contain an express credibility finding. There is a specific finding at transcript 24 at which the ALJ expressly concludes that the allegations are not fully credible for the reasons set forth in the body of the decision. Moreover, if you refer to the body of the decision at transcripts 22 and 23, we see that the ALJ did conduct exactly the type of credibility analysis that is required by the regulations. He considered this guy's considerable activities, and he led quite a full life during this period that he claims to have been continually disabled. He and his wife had children during this period. He was the primary caregiver to this. He was quite active. He also, in addition to the activities, he considered the medical opinion, the medical evidence, this individual's treatment, his medications, and his work history. As I indicated, this individual's work history was a relevant factor for this ALJ to consider in assessing the veracity of his claims of being unable to work. So the second, in both decisions, the ALJ did conduct appropriate credibility assessments. In the second decision, where he was specifically directed to assess the mental impairment, he found this individual's claims not fully credible. And he did. So have I responded to your question adequately, Your Honor?
So, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court observed that reasonable minds could differ with respect to the evidence concerning this individual's physical impairments and his mental impairments. In such a case, the ALJ is responsible, in fact, he's required, to resolve the conflicts in the evidence and issue factual determinations. In doing so, he does not, as we hear charged in the briefs and in other disability cases, he did not impermissibly play doctor. He did not ignore any evidence. He did not reject an opinion and substitute his own. With respect to the emotional impairments, we have four sources of evidence. We have Dr. Kennedy, who is the treating psychiatrist, and we have some of his treatment records. We have Dr. Martin, who is an examining psychologist. Dr. Martin is the only individual who has administered a complete barrage of diagnostic psychological tests. Then we have plaintiff's hired expert that they sent to rehabilitate the record, Dr. Czarnecki. And then we also have the state agency in mental health professionals who reviewed the record. The ALJ acknowledged that he was giving them the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt and finding him considerably more limited than the state agency reviewers. The ALJ found perhaps if this panel was reviewing the evidence, it might have relied more on Dr. Kennedy's opinion. The ALJ expressly explained why he looked through Dr. Kennedy's contemporaneous treatment notes, and he simply did not find anything in there that would suggest limitations as severe as Dr. Kennedy did, as he stated in his one paragraph thing, saying, I believe it was a global assessment functioning score of 30 to 40, which is rather profoundly limited. In his treatment notes, there's no mention of this individual being unable to work because of his mental impairments or having significant social deficits due to his tremendous emotional impairments. That's exactly the type of weighing of the evidence that the ALJ is required to do. He expressly did it, set forth his reasoning in a manner that allows this court meaningful review by this court. As such, the ALJ's express resolution of this conflicting evidence should be affirmed. It's a similar situation with respect to the physical impairments. Plaintiff alleged contends Dr. Heathers and Drs. Green Mack. Consistent with the ALJ, we've got Drs. Cassia, Drs. McLemore, Drs. Trammell. Plaintiff refers to those doctors, Cassia and McLemore, as believing there are considerable psychological issues. But these doctors consistently, these are the treating neurologists, treating neurosurgeons, and consulting orthopedists, returned him to work without limitations. Said he is not as limited as he presents himself as being. That's addressed. The medical evidence is set forth at length in the briefs. I'm certainly prepared and eager to discuss it to whatever extent this court may wish. But if there are not any specific questions, I'll move on to another, just very briefly, a couple of issues. With respect to this need to alternate between sitting and standing, plaintiff's putting a lot of weight on two check marks in the record in which Drs. Heathers and Drs. Green-Mack checked a mark that said he will need to alternate his position more than once every two hours. That's the check mark. The ALJ found that this individual could perform work that allowed him to sit or allowed him to stand as long as once an hour he was permitted to alternate his position for 1 to 2 minutes. Alternating your position for 1 to 2 minutes every hour is consistent with the check marks saying that he has to alternate his position at least once every 2 hours. These check marks were too vague to present to the vocational expert. And this is the evidence that plaintiff chose to submit in support of his claim. The ALJ was doing exactly what was required of him by the Social Security rulings, and he was putting some precision to this specific postural limitation in a manner that the vocational expert could interpret and respond to. I urge this court not to penalize this ALJ's reasonable interpretation of what I submit was vague check marks by these doctors on these forms.
Was the vocational expert ever asked to answer a hypothetical question or otherwise testify with respect to the emotional psychiatric impairments?
I'm not certain as to what that question what questions. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
The one question I can remember on this, he was not added. It was not included within the question, but I'm not sure which point in the proceedings that question was asked.
My time is up. I urge this court to reject plaintiff's waiver argument, which they advanced at length in their briefs. And lacking any further questions, I urge this court to affirm the commissioner's final decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Studinski. How much time does Ms. Goldblum have? She has a minute left.
Just a few points. To begin with, plaintiff is actually not going to ask the court to rule on the waiver argument either. It was advanced initially, but we'd like to focus on the issues at hand and the merits.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your sentence.
Plaintiff, we're not going to ask that this court rule on the waiver argument that was included in the first brief. But to the merits of this case, first of all, counsel makes a big issue of the fact that this gentleman filed a lot of applications. Well, he had a lot of injuries, he had back problems, but particularly the application he filed right before the one that is the subject here, he filed that application, he had surgery, but then while it was pending, he went back to work. The fact that he didn't call Social Security and withdraw it, I don't think we can take anything from that. He did what he had a family, and he went back to work. Excuse me. And in fact, as this court has said, for instance, in the Perlman case, the fact that someone works with a disability is not inconsistent. Just very briefly, if you'll allow me, this gentleman did not have a very busy lifestyle. It was quite circumscribed. His family helped him out with the kids. And finally, the administrative law judge accepted that there was a need for a sit-stand option and didn't explain it. And I'm sorry.
We do have the point on that, and your time has expired. Thank you, Ms. Goldblum.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.